Welcome to Knock Knock, Who's There? A fitness podcast, the official voice of the Knock Academy, an online fitness experience. Each week, we will talk about current and popular fitness topics and keep it real by featuring our Academy members sharing the successes and struggles of their fitness journeys. We will also welcome fitness industry experts talking about a wide range of health and wellness topics. Thanks for joining us.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
It's Danielle.
Danielle, welcome back to the show. First returning guest. How are you today?
I'm really good. I am honored to be the first returning guest. It's really nice.
There you go. There was definitely some more stuff we needed to talk about. For everyone listening that has been tuning into the show and recognizes Danielle's voice or recognizes her picture from the marketing or whatever that might be, will know that Danielle's been on to share her story as a member of the Knock Academy. So we had an incredible conversation about your kind of history with exercise and how that kind of evolved through your life to current day. And it was such a great conversation. And what we also found out, for anyone that listened and remembered, that you also have some pretty good credentials when it comes to the world of nutrition. And we're going to talk about that today. We're going to dig into nutrition. We're going to cover all sorts of things. I've got a list here that's going to probably take way longer than the time we've got allocated, but we're going to do our best to fit it in. And we're going to really offer some value to everyone tuning in today on the topic of nutrition. But before we do that, we're going to hear from you, Danielle, about why you're coming on to have this conversation. Why you? Why are you qualified to have this chat with me today? Tell us all about it.
Well, I am actually currently right now, I'm a professor of nutrition at a university in Manitoba. So I've had a long kind of history and experience with nutrition, but it's kind of interesting because if you had asked me when I was like 18 or 20 years old, if this is where I would be at 42 now, there's no way I would have ever thought that I would be in this position and be studying nutrition. Because when I started in university, when I was 18, I actually wanted to be a physiotherapist. I'm clearly not a physiotherapist now because my first year of university did not go as planned. I didn't study very much and I did not get the grades that I needed to get into the physiotherapy program. So kind of as a fluke, I was sort of in this position where I was, you know, thinking, well, what am I going to do now? What's my backup plan? And I took an intro nutrition course at university and like totally fell in love with it. Found it so interesting, you know, the way nutrients and nutrition works in our body, how our body is basically a machine. And if you don't fuel it properly, it's not going to work for you the way you want it to. It didn't hurt that I got an A in the class too. So that kind of pushed me along. So I finished my undergrad in nutrition. I kind of figured out a really popular career path in nutrition is to go on to dietetics and become a registered dietitian and do nutrition counseling with people. I didn't want to explore that possibility at that point. So I ended up going on to do a master's degree in nutrition. And I studied a fatty acid and fatty liver disease and obesity. So I did that for about two and a half years. And that wasn't enough for me. So I continued on and I ended up doing a PhD in nutrition. And during my PhD research, I studied a grain. Well, it's not really a grain, a food called buckwheat. I don't know if you've ever heard of buckwheat before. Yeah. So I studied buckwheat and some of the plant chemicals, the plant compounds in buckwheat and how it helps your body basically break down and metabolize sugar. So looking at glucose metabolism when people eat buckwheat. So I've been studying nutrition for a long time and I was really lucky and fortunate enough to get a position in a kinesiology and applied health department at a university. And now I teach nutrition, I teach sports nutrition, I teach human physiology. So it's a nice kind of intersection of all of those topics. And I still, you know, even despite studying this topic for so long, I still find it so fascinating because there's, you know, we're always learning new things and the field is evolving. And, you know, originally when I finished my undergrad, I didn't think that the, you know, counseling part of nutrition was for me initially because I was, you know, really didn't really think that people would do a good job of listening to me. but now I find that that's one of the most important parts of being a nutritionist, is being able to take that science and the research and, you know, the kind of complicated things that we know, and being able to tell people about it in ways that's meaningful for them, and in ways that they understand. So it's really wonderful to be able to talk to you today about that.
Yeah, well, that's incredible. And if this was a job interview, you just got the job. So well done. it's not, but some incredible credentials. I listening to that story, I was like, yeah, I should have probably spent some more time at school, because I sound like you kind of you went all after the study, which I love, because it is one of those topics where we have to get so in depth with it, and there's so much to learn, as you said, and it's always evolving. I mean, the foundation of it stays the same. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of progresses from there. And, you know, there's so much opinion and thought out there around it. So it's so important that there are people doing that research and diving into that stuff, because the world of fitness is very much the same. I mean, the basics are still the same as they've been for many, many years. And then those little nuances that come within it, and then there's opinion. And then, so there needs to be those people really digging in and hopefully communicating that information out to the world of health and fitness professionals, so we can communicate it. So amazing job.
So what's that, the line at the end that Nikki says, is it at the end of this podcast, the 90% opinion and 10% fact? It's the same for nutrition. Like, they are basically sister disciplines. They go hand in hand.
Yeah. We live by that. And actually, somebody sent me an Instagram reel the other day of someone bashing on a certain exercise, that I'm not going to get into it, but said to me, you know, what's your thoughts on this? And I said, yeah, and I sat on it for a bit. And then I eventually replied back and just said, as far as I'm concerned, it's really about opinion, and it's about, you know, are you programming it well? Because really, there's no bad exercises. There's sometimes ill-advised and overused and, you know, incorrectly prescribed to people, but it doesn't make it a bad exercise. It's about how you coach it, how you deliver it, and how you understand it. And I feel like nutrition is the same a lot of the time when it comes to food and food choices. So very aligned. So I think with that being said, we should dive into some important nutrition. And I kind of touched on it there, and I'd love to start there. I'd love to start on the theory that is out there. I don't know if it's a theory or an opinion. It's an opinion for sure. An opinion that there are good and bad foods. And I'd love to hear your take on this, because I have a very interesting relationship with food, and labeling foods is something that I really struggled with throughout my career as a fitness professional, and how it affected my life. So I'd love to get kind of some insight on your thoughts on good and bad food. Do we have good and bad foods? Is there a better way to label it? And how do we approach that as a human being, but even more importantly, as a parent as well, because that will link in a lot for both yourself and me, because we both have kids of similar age. So we're definitely navigating that. So yeah, take it away. What are your thoughts?
Yeah,
that's
a great, really great question. Really, I think this question's been explored a lot and really coming to light more, because definitely in the past, there was this just tendency, because it's easy, right, to say a food is bad or a food is good. Don't eat that food, it's bad for you. Eat lots of this food, it's good for you, it's healthy for you. My opinion, and I think a lot of opinion, and it makes sense too. So I would say that it is more a helpful fact than opinion, that labeling foods as good or bad is not productive. It's actually not helpful. All foods have a place in our diets, right? There's room for all foods in our diets. There's some foods that we don't want to eat as often, you know, that we maybe want to limit in our diets, but there's definitely room for all foods in what we eat. The problem, what can end up happening if you label foods as bad foods and you restrict them, what happens when I tell you, you can't have this food? You want it even more, right? So with restriction, what tends to happen when you're telling yourself, I can't have this food, it's bad for me, you want it even more, right? And you'll go, you know, days and days and days without eating it. And then you're like, okay, well, maybe I'll just have a little bit. You have a little bit, but then you want even more. And then you want more. And before you know it, you've totally overdone it and you've kind of binged on this bad food. So the better way I think of labeling foods is healthy, not healthy, or foods that you don't, you know, that you don't want to eat as often, or you know, foods that you want to eat more often. And I think it's especially important with kids. And I see this with my own son. They are watching you, right? They're always listening to you. So if you're labeling foods as bad and you're restricting, they are seeing that you're doing that. And they start to, you know, sort of take this on and ingrain this in themselves and think that these are foods that are bad for me. I can't have them. I don't, shouldn't eat these. They might even start to feel bad about themselves if they do eat those bad foods, you know, that you've labeled that way. So I think the balance really needs to shift more towards, you know, that all foods fit sort of model. And just knowing that there are certain foods out there that you don't, you know, maybe those are the foods you don't have every day. You know, you have them every other day, or, you know, whatever. I've just been recently following a dietitian actually online who, and this has been taking me a long time to wrap my head around, because I definitely grew up with the family that, you know, if you ate all your dinner, then you would get dessert, right? So sort of incentivizing certain foods, which just makes kids want to eat them even more, or forces kids to eat until they feel over full in order to get that dessert or that treat food. So she is reframing things and saying, well, why can't kids have dessert before, you know, before they have dinner, you know, just let them have that, and sort of take away that idea of putting certain sort of treat foods on a pedestal and just normalizing it as a food. And actually she doesn't label foods as good or bad or put any labels on them. Food is food. You know, it is, it is what it is.
Yeah, I love that. And something I have to go back to real quickly, because I was chuckling to myself, was when you got small kids, they're always listening, apart from when you want them to.
Yes. Yeah, that is true.
And they come up with something from like 3 days ago and you're like, how do you not listen to me when I ask you to put your shoes on, but you can remember something I said 3 days ago? Yeah. So they do. And they'll pick up the littlest things that you think they don't. It's very amusing. So anyone that has young kids will be laughing away to themselves now and know that that's completely true. I love that approach. And I always think of it like in our house, we kind of have this spectrum of these are the healthier types of foods that we're going to have more often in our diet. These are the less healthier foods that we're going to have sometimes. And they're all included, right? And it's, you know, we have a certain day, or we have a certain, you know, like you said, a certain time, or just because you asked for it and it was appropriate. Or like, you know, we had a weekend where there was a lot of treats, and Monday it was like, could I have some dessert after my dinner? And I'm like, today we're not going to have any dessert, but you can have some fruit, or you can have something else if you're still hungry. However, we're going to wait a few days, because we had a lot of that stuff over the last few days, and we want to have that a little less often, and trying to understand that spectrum without demonizing something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's seems to be working okay right now. However, who knows, because parenting is is quite the chaotic environment. But for us, it, like you said, it plays a massive part, right, in how we approach it. And we have that kind of binging effect with the food, as you said. You kind of start, and here's the thing as well with that type of food, let's take like ice cream for an example, because it's basically sugar-coated fat. So it's going to be, it's high density, it's high calorie, it's not got a lot of nutrients in it, and it just doesn't fill you up. Everybody can eat a tub of ice cream, probably want to throw up afterwards, but it's never really going to fill you up. And it's one of those types of things, because it's such a nice flavor and taste, and what it does to our body chemically and physically. And then the other part of it, that, you know, you can eat loads of it. You can't eat, you know, 100, you know, sit there and eat 100 grams or 200 grams of broccoli, but you can eat a whole tub of ice cream. So we have to look at that, like the volume of food and how we react to it. So I love that we just kind of say, yeah, hey, have a little bit, and, you know, have a small amount of food, and just be aware that those things that have got higher sugar, higher fat content, they're not going to fill you up. And they've also got more, well, the fat's got more calories per gram, so you're going to get that much more intake of energy than you typically would. So we just have to be aware, like you said, and they're part of our food intake for most people. And coming from a life of working in the fitness industry as a teenager and living on broccoli, chicken, rice, steak, like, and not a lot else, it doesn't pay well for the future when you restrict like that, because it does end up in that cycle. So I really like that approach. And I think we should definitely be trying to find ways to educate everybody as nutrition professionals, fitness professionals, and as parents, because that's another key place where it comes in. And as you said, how they label themselves in association to that is also key. And hey, listen, that's so important outside of the conversation of nutrition.
So I have a couple follow-up things that I need to say too, because I sort of forgot about them. So the other thing, like, especially with kids, it's so important to really watch your language around food. I think everybody knows this, but just want to reinforce this point, because what we learn as kids is generally what we carry with us for the rest of our lives, right? And it's so hard to break certain habits or certain things, you know, that we heard growing up as children. So basically, and it's a lot of pressure for a parent, because what we're talking about and the words we're using and the language we're using is really going to stick with them for the rest of their lives. So if we start labeling foods as good and bad at that early age and starting, you know, to give them those messages that, you know, you shouldn't eat these foods, they're not good for you, they're not good for your body, the chances are they're going to live with that for a long time. And it's really hard to reframe. Like, I've had to do it and I still struggle with it. Like, I've really had to reframe the way I think about food and the way I interact with food. So we really, really want to watch that language with kids. And it's not just language with kids. You also have to watch yourself, because they listen when they want to, and they also watch a lot, right? So they watch what you're eating. They watch what you're not eating. So if they're having dessert after dinner and you're not, they're going to start to wonder why, right? Like, why isn't mommy having that food, or why isn't daddy? So I think we have to watch our language. We also have to watch our actions.
Yeah. And I'll just add to that, that when we talk about actions and people watching, the people around, anyone we're being a role model to. So we're not just talking directly to parents, although it's an, you know, a big part of our market at the Knock Academy, is anyone you're being a role model to are going to pick up on your actions and your habits. So, you know, whether it's nutrition, the words we use, you know, talking about foods being bad or eating this food's going to make you fat, for example, right? Those kind of things that kids just automatically ingrained in their brain. It's the same with exercise. If we're not motivated to go out and go for a walk, to get some extra steps in, to, you know, do some movement at home or whatever it might be, or go to the gym, like, they hear these things and they see those things. So role model that to anybody in your life, just like you would with the food you eat and your habits around meals. Do the same with your movement and your activity. And we're going to hopefully promote this ingrained habit. It just becomes habitual for the next generation, whatever that looks like. So important. And I love that you added that, because language is key. And you actually said something earlier that I was just thinking about again, which was, when you tell someone not to eat something, they want to eat it. Well, welcome to the world of coaching. So any fitness professionals, we have some that listen to the show. So remember that when you're coaching people, if you're telling everyone that you're coaching not to do things in a certain movement, you know, don't round your shoulders, don't round your back. Guess what? The minute you say that, it's going to implant that thought in their head, and then you wonder why they're not getting something. So start talking about what we want to see, right? And how we want to address things within our nutrition, rather than what you can't have, right? Because it always has that same effect. And anyone who's a parent or owns an animal will know that that's the same thing. You tell them not to do something, first thing they do is they do it. So there you go. There's a life lesson and a coaching lesson.
And you would also never want your kid to feel, or you to feel, that, you know, if you want a bad food, like, if you're using that word bad food, well, if I want a bad food, which everybody wants the bad foods, right? Like the ice cream and the, like, I'm sorry, they taste good. We all want them. Does that mean I'm bad for wanting it because it's bad? Like, so you just don't want, like, yeah, you don't want to message food that way. So
yeah. Well, yeah, anything. And good point that the logical brain of, you know, the less developed brain of a younger person is not going to be able to figure that out from a logical standpoint, where they go hand in hand, right? bad thing or bad choice makes me bad as an adult, although not all of us are able to differentiate those two things, right? It's maybe you made a less than desirable choice, or you chose something that wasn't as healthy, but that doesn't change who you are as a person. So yeah, super important. Now, with that being said, because we touched on a few things about, you know, the amount of calories in foods and, you know, the amount of how these things kind of can negatively impact the amount of energy or calories we take in, I'd love to dig a little bit now into diet culture. So this is is it a $33 billion industry or something in North America? Like, it's insane. And when I say diet culture, I mean the physical going on a diet or anything that fits in that bracket. And I'd love to hear a little bit about just a kind of general overview of any diet that's out there. To my knowledge, and correct me if I'm wrong, is there's nothing I've ever found in 20 odd years of kind of, you know, studying it and looking into these things, that there's no magical diet, quote unquote. And especially when we're talking about weight loss, which is typically what I just referred to, the diet culture, the weight loss industry, is when we're looking at managing our weight, because sometimes we need to increase it, sometimes we need to decrease it, we can make adjustments in our nutrition. And there's many ways out there that claim to be the best way to do it. What I'd love to hear about is when we go on a diet, or we choose one of the best ways we saw on Instagram or Facebook, is why does it work? How does it work? That might be a really long question or a long answer. And is there really any difference between any of these things? And is there any, you know, advice for anyone looking for ways to manage their weight with, if it's their health and fitness goal?
So, and we're talking strictly now from a standpoint of weight loss, right? Because that's like you said, typically why most people are looking to change the way they're eating and to change their dietary patterns. So you are right. There really is no magic bullet. There is no one solution, because honestly, like, to lose weight, you really just have to be burning more calories than you're taking in. So when you look at, you know, a lot of the popular diets that are out there, so like, for example, the ketogenic diet, the paleo diet, Mediterranean diet, Atkins, like any of those sort of low carbohydrate diets, they all claim to work for weight loss for a specific purpose. So the ketogenic diet, because it, you know, pushes your body towards, you know, you eat low carbohydrates, so it pushes your body to burn more fat versus carbohydrates, so you lose weight that way. With a paleo diet, weight loss happens because you're eating closer to the way that we ate when we were caveman hunter gatherers, when everybody was lean and thin. With low carbohydrate diet, same thing, because you're eating more, your body's being pushed to burn more fat for energy versus carbohydrate. But honestly, when you look at all of those diets as a whole, they all really have one thing in common. They're getting you to eat more fruits and vegetables, less refined carbohydrates, so less sugar, less cake, less cookies, less chips, and eating more whole foods. So even though they all claim to be the magic bullet or the magic diet, because, you know, they're getting you to eat really specifically, it all boils down to the fact that you're eating less calories, because you're eating more fruits and vegetables, you're eating more, you know, whole grains, or you're eating more lean protein, and you're eating less high calorie energy dense foods like cake, cookies, ice cream, chips. So really, there is no magic bullet there. They're all doing the same thing, but just in a, you know, with a different cloak or a different costume on.
Yeah. And my understanding, having looked into it and kind of, you know, is much the same. We talk about much the same whenever we discuss nutrition or coaching my clients over many years. It's the same thing. You need to create a deficit in that energy or a deficit in calories. And it's so funny. There's so many ways, like you said, to do it, right? You reduce, take a food group out, right? Low carb, suddenly you've done that. You can go, you know, you go back 20 years, 25 years, it was all about low fat, take the fat out. Why? Because it's got twice as many calories per gram. So if you take fat out of your diet, well, A, yes, you're going to get that result of reducing the, or you're creating a deficit in energy that's going in. There's a whole other lot of health complications that come with that. So that's definitely not a great option. And there's so many ways. And then you've got things like that are not kind of food group focused, but things like intermittent fasting, where people fast for a certain period of time. And one of my favorite fitness people on the internet that I like to follow, that makes me laugh a lot, always says, It's intermittent fasting or skipping breakfast, which is basically what it is. You skip a meal, and then when you skip a meal, suddenly a third of your calories disappeared, and then you created that deficit of energy. There's a million ways to do it. What I will say is, if you look into it, and you can basically feed anything that you believe, there's things on the internet to feed that. There's things in books to feed that. Like, you can feed any narrative that you want to believe. So there is some research and studies from what I've seen to suggest that maybe there is a little bit more fat burnt for energy in that diet. And maybe there is a bit more, you know, there's also lots of links to things like insulin when, you know, and fat loss when we reduce down our carbohydrate intake. And there is some studies and there is some proof, and you can find it if you go and look for it, to show that there's a marginal amount. And because of that, people hook onto it and say, well, that must be the way. That's the magic way to burn fat. I'm like, no, because if you look at the hierarchy of it, the basis of that hierarchy is that it's reducing the amount of calories you take in. And that's the number one reason why it's working. And are there other things impacting it? Yes. And it always reminds me of the days where, and anyone that has been on a treadmill, maybe not so recently, but definitely in the past, has seen that there's a thing called a fat burning zone on the heart rate thing. And it tells you that if you work at a certain heart rate, you're going to burn fat. So people would do it all the time. And as I had to spend my whole career explaining to people, is the percentage that you burn technically from stored energy or fat is higher when you work in that certain heart rate zone, which is a little bit lower than typically you'd see with cardiovascular exercise. So yes, it's technically true. However, because of the intensity, you burn a lot less overall calories. So actually, it doesn't balance itself out the same way. And if it did, you'd have to be doing like 4 hours of walking at like 60% of your maximum heart rate, which really, we haven't got time to work out for 30 minutes. Let alone 4 hours on the treadmill, whatever it is. But that was the science behind it. And there was some truth behind the science. So I feel that with nutrition, it can be very much the same. Would you agree?
Definitely agree. And I think you're right. There is research and there are studies to show that, you know, like the basic metabolism, you know, the theory behind why the ketogenic diet works the way it works is true. Like, yes, if you do eat a very low carbohydrate diet, your body has no choice but to burn fat for energy. Like, it's got to get the energy from somewhere. So it's going to go to fat to do that. And that's true. And a lot of people who go on lower carbohydrate diets, like the ketogenic diet, will see weight loss pretty quickly, right? Like, it happens pretty quickly. But the thing is, like, it's a restrictive diet. So what you find, like, yes, weight loss within the first month or two, but there haven't been as many studies that go longer than that. So if you do look at the few studies that go longer than that, you see the weight loss start to drop off or start to slow down because, number one, it's not sustainable for everybody. So if it's not a diet that works for you, like not a dietary pattern, I should say. So if it's not a way of eating that works for you that you like, you're not going to stick with it. You're going to go off the keto diet or low carb diet or whatever diet, intermittent fasting, whatever, you're just going to go back to the way that you were eating before. Right. So that's not conducive to weight loss, and you might even gain back some weight, maybe even more. And actually there are a couple studies that I know of, that have followed people on low carbohydrate, versus, just, you know, your standard traditional energy restricted diet for a year and maybe even longer, 18 months or maybe even 2 years. And at the end of the 2 years, the low carbohydrate diet is no more or no less effective than just the traditional energy restricted diet for weight loss. So how you get to the end there, you know, if it works for you, if you like lots of protein and you like lots of fat in your diet and a low carb diet works for you and it's sustainable, then that's the one you want to go with. But if you like bread and you like pasta and that's, you know, torture for you to be on that kind of diet, well, then maybe that's not the one for you. And there's other ways to get weight loss.
Yeah, I just couldn't think of anything more miserable in my existence than that, because pastries and cookies and burgers and sandwiches and cereal. And so it's a big no for me. But yeah, as you said, if that's something you love, then go ahead and get that in your diet. However, again, much like fitness and nutrition, as you mentioned earlier, Danielle, that, you know, the industry is 10% fact and 90% opinion. So the type of workout, the best workout to get in shape, the best workout to build muscle, lose fat, whatever it is, there isn't really a best workout. And as you said, if you're going to do this type of workout that you hate and it makes you miserable and it's not sustainable and you're going to get injured, guess what? You're not going to do it consistently. And that is, again, we talk about hierarchies. This is the thing holding it up, is doing something consistently, finding a way to eat that you can do consistently, right? For me, I have to make sure I hit my protein intake first. Number one, I have to get that in my day. It's really important because I'm very, very active all day long. Then I'm going to look at, what do I eat that helps me maintain this steady state of energy during the day? And also, what's going to stop me wanting to eat, you know, 1,000 calories of something that's on less than healthy on the spectrum that we spoke about earlier, you know, at 9 o'clock at night.
Right.
So the simple thing, I know it works for me. I've tried everything. I've done everything as kind of an experiment. So it is so true. And you have to find that thing, the way of eating and nutrition that works for you. And typically the less extreme or the less black and white those choices are when it comes to exercise and nutrition, in my experience, the longer people maintain them.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Because everybody's different, right? Like there's really only, I would say, five, like with popular diets, there's really only probably five of them, I would say. Like there's a lot that are sort of mirrors of each other, but you know, with only having five different ways of eating is not realistic, right? Everybody's different. You have to find what works for you, right? And what's sustainable for you and what you can be consistent with, because just like with exercise, the key, not just to weight loss, but even just healthy dietary patterns and healthy eating, is consistency. Like, what are you going to be able to stick with over the long run?
Yeah, it's so true. And it also, to kind of tag onto that, is when we're in that constant state of weight loss and we're kind of managing that weight, is there's also other things that we people don't consider, which is you want to also be keeping your body strong so you're able to do things. You want to be able to keep, you know, up with your kids or keep up with your lifestyle that you choose. Maybe people want to build muscle and get stronger. These things, you struggle to do these things when your calorie intake is too low, right? You can build muscle while you're in a deficit of calories. Yes, you can. As again, lots of research to suggest you can. Most people don't. There is some research to back it. But really, when you think about energy, I think about me on a day where I haven't eaten very well, I'm in a bad mood. I don't want to run around the park with my kid. I don't want to do a workout because I don't have any energy. So you got to think about it. It's not just as simple as, well, if I reduce the amount. So it's how much you reduce it or how you manage it, and maybe in the cycles that you do it. So it has to make sense for you. But I love that we're totally on the same page and, you know, talking at it from a scientific place, that, like you said, there is stuff out there and we can feed that narrative. And hey, listen, that's another life lesson. Whatever you choose to believe out there, keep your eyes wide open, because you can feed your own narrative of what you believe to be true with any little snippet of truth and information that's out there in the world. So just, we're not going to achieve that. Be a whole other conversation. But it's so
that's
true.
Just not fitness and nutrition. That's like
yes, everything. So we're going to leave from there. So basically the rule is, we'll summarize this. The rule is if you're looking to manage your weight in some capacity and keep a handle on that, so it isn't too low and it isn't too high, be aware of what you're eating, find a way that you eat that works for you, but no, stop looking for the magic bullet and the easy way, because there isn't one. We just have to be consistent and make those great, healthier choices on the spectrum more often than not. And we're going to keep ourselves in good health, and hopefully we're going to be great role models. So I love that we were able to kind of bring all that together. And a thing that ties into that as well is people will say, well, I did this style of eating or diet, or I've been working out really, really hard and I feel my body shape's changing, but I can't get rid of this last little bit of, and I'm going to say it's like belly fat or fat around the hips for women, because typically men it's waist, men it's women. And this is what I've been fighting my entire career, 22 years nearly. Is, well, I'm going to do crunches or I'm going to do lots of glute bridges because that will help me shape up this area of my body. Tell us, Danielle, is your body able, because you, as we've heard, you have the credentials to tell us, are we physiologically able to reduce body fat in a certain area by targeting it with a movement?
No, I'm sorry. I wish I could tell you something different. I wish, like, from my own personal standpoint, I wish that were true, but unfortunately is not. No. And even for a while there was some research. I don't know, the fatty acid that I, the type of fat that I studied with my, in my master's degree was called CLA, conjugated linoleic acid. And it was huge for like a long time. And there were even, you know, studies to show that if you had a diet that was high in this fat, that you could reduce abdominal fat. So you could reduce belly fat. So yeah, it reduces belly fat in mice or belly fat in rats. But, you know, when we, because that's where we start with research usually is with animals. But then when you try to go to humans, we don't see those same effects. So sorry, there's no, as far as I know, no movement, no food that you can eat. Coconut oil will not reduce belly fat. That's another one that I've heard too. So
yeah, well, the CLA one, hey, listen, I've spent plenty of money on that supplement in the past. So I get it. Absolutely get it. And there's many, many of those out there. So let's just be clear that no supplement. And also as well, listen, if you tick off the 50 other things you need to be doing first and you're still not getting what you want, there might be a supplement for some, not necessarily that one, but there might be a supplement out there for you. So yeah. And again, if you do your research, you're going to find lots of stuff that says, yep, you can definitely use that supplement to get this, this, and this. However, realistically, in the grand schemes of things, there's so many other factors, right? Is taking a CLA supplement for your nutrition, for your, you know, reducing belly fat, but your nutrition's poor and you don't get enough exercise and you're not moving and you're drinking too much at the weekend, guess what? If it was going to do something, it's not going to do anything without the other boxes ticked, right? So, you know, I talk about this with recovery all the time as well. What's the best thing for recovery? I'm like, go to bed and sleep until you're getting like 7, and I did an episode about this, so you'll be able to hear that in the back catalog, everyone, is if you're not getting 7 to 9 hours sleep a night and getting good quality recovery, don't bother. Don't go there until you've done this. Like, don't sleep for 3 hours and then try and take a supplement that's going to help you recover. It's not going to work. Same thing, right? Anyway, back to the point. Yes, there's no exercises. So stop doing 50 billion abdominal crunches thinking that it's going to tone up your midsection, because it's not. And most people probably don't need to do any more spinal flexion than they're already doing all day long. So a little bit, yes, but it's just another muscle group that we work that creates a movement in the body. So I love that we were able to bust that myth. Now, we touched on supplement myths. So we're going to go into a controversial one now, because this one is on my list and it feels like it's a good time to talk about it. Artificial sweeteners. You mentioned about rats and mice and how these studies are done on, not on human beings. And I know that a lot of the research on artificial sweeteners is also done on animals or rats and mice. I'd love to get a little take on it. This one gets a bad rap for being unhealthy, bad for us. It's going to give you cancer. The list goes on. What are the general thoughts around in the world of nutrition at the level you're at around artificial sweeteners? And we can talk about why they could be beneficial and maybe the health concerns that come with them.
So the artificial sweetener from the nutrition community, the message is not going to be like, I'm going to start to sound like a broken record. They're okay in moderation, like everything else that we eat, right? Everything is okay in moderation. And you definitely hit on the important point there. So there has been a lot of negativity around using artificial sweeteners like aspartame. Aspartame by far is the most villainized one, but there's other ones out there, sucralose. I'm blanking on some of the other ones. Stevia is another one. But, you know, specifically with aspartame, and, you know, it's going to give you liver cancer or brain cancer, or, you know, it's toxic. The studies that I think are linked to that were all done in animals. So probably in mice and in rats, giving these poor mice and rats mega, mega doses of aspartame and mega doses of artificial sweeteners. Huge doses that no human would ever reasonably be able to eat or to drink, you know, in a diet pop per day. So yes, maybe aspartame will give you cancer if you drink, you know, 100 liters of diet pop every day for the next 5 years, you know, but having, you know, a diet pop one a day, even one a day is probably not going to do any harm to you. If you don't like them, like I don't have them because I just don't like the way they taste. I think they taste really fake and kind of gross. So if you don't like them, then don't include them in your diet, but don't be scared or nervous that you're going to get sick from having them.
Yep. I love that. And it is in so many things. And here's, so firstly, yes, again, you can feed any narrative that you want to believe. So there is research, like you said, to say, oh, it's going to give you brain cancer. I remember going on a seminar once, and this person had done some kind of research on the amount, and it was something like 12 cans of Diet Coke a day. And the period of time is, again, something like, it was like 7 years or something, like that extended period of time and build up, that's how much it would take. I'm like, well, no one's drinking that much in a day. I'm pretty sure of it. I mean, there might be the odd person, but like me, that probably drinks, I don't know, 2 or 3 cans of Coke Zero a week, I think it's going to kill me. Right. Yeah. That's kind of where I'm at with it. I'm like, it's going to be a very small amount. So yes, it's a very important message, because there are many things, and there's different types, as you said, of sweeteners, and some that are maybe a bit more natural than others, and other ones that aren't. Here's where they serve a purpose from my standpoint, from a coaching standpoint. And when, you know, I talk about people's habits around food and nutrition, is sometimes they're going to have their place because they are zero calorie, and some people are trying to manage. And someone like me who has an extremely sweet tooth, like I could live on sugary stuff all day long, I'd be more than happy. Like if you gave me a big bowl of sugary cereal and then like a, I don't know, like a wrap or something, and then, you know, I'd have quite easily have like full sugar drinks all the time. Like I could live on that. I couldn't, because I'd probably die eventually. But I could easily live on that. No problem whatsoever. And if I could skip over and eat 12 grams of protein a day, and I don't think I'd notice. So for me, and the way my body is and what I crave, is it's a great tool. I use it as a tool because I don't want to be consuming an extra 150 calories, 200 calories, or even more than that in liquid when I'm trying to hit a certain protein intake, or I'm trying to just manage the calorie intake I've got. Sometimes do I have things that are higher in sugar? Yes, because that's life. However, if I can manage that, that's a great way to do it. And I like the taste, so I drink it. So there's where it can be a tool. And if you look, there's a lot of great people online that are showing this research with sweeteners and stuff, and talking to exactly what we're talking about now, and showing that it's been shown in studies to be a useful tool for those people trying to, when you're looking at weight management, people that are trying to reduce those overall calories, it's a great substitution. So there you have it. It is not, is it on the spectrum of super healthy? No. Is it going to kill you? Are you going to die of cancer? No.
No.
Well, you might, but probably not because of that, because that's life. Yeah. And it's such a big, I mean, we could probably talk about that for hours on its own. So that's kind of one thing ticked off. And we touched on, obviously, the different types of diets and the ketos. And I also talked on protein intake a lot. Now, in the world of health and fitness, this is another big one. Don't eat more than 30 grams of protein in a meal, because A, you can't absorb it, or B, it's going to, you know, you're going to get liver failure, your kidneys, your everything else. Like it's going to, you know, but your digestive system is going to get ruined by it. Where does the kind of study lie with higher protein diets, especially in the world of like bodybuilding, fitness competitors, people that want to change their physique? We obviously need protein, and we can talk to why it's important. What's the kind of research suggesting out there? Because again, there's a lot of things to suggest that high protein is not good for our health.
Yeah. So, and actually the whole world of protein in the nutrition field is kind of, it's not controversial. That's not the right word, but there's a lot of question marks actually around what the optimal amount of protein, even, you know, just not even someone who's looking to build muscle mass, but just for everyday people, for health, what's the proper amount of protein that we should be taking in? And for many, many years, it's been at the certain set amount based on your body weight, 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram body weight. But the more and more we learn about protein, it's starting to look like that's a bit of an underestimation, and people should be getting more protein than that. But then the question then becomes, well, what's too much protein? And I think the original thoughts and kind of concern with higher protein diets was how it would affect your kidneys, because when you eat protein and your body takes it up and absorbs it and starts using it to make muscle and bone and like hormones and all the other things that protein is used for in your body, through metabolism, your body does produce this waste product, urea, that has to be flushed out from your body. And the organ that does that is your kidneys. So the thought previously was, if you eat a diet that's really high in protein, you're going to be making a lot of this waste product. It's going to be stressing out your kidneys and eventually cause them to get overworked and exhausted and can lead to kidney failure. That is not the case. So that's another myth busted right there. So a high protein diet, as long as you have healthy kidney function to start with, you will not damage your kidneys by having a high protein diet. Now, if you do have kidney problems, so if you have an underlying kidney issue or kidney disease, then you definitely don't want to go high protein. But just for, you know, for most people out there, a high protein diet is going to be fine. And again, there's a little bit of controversy and question marks around the optimal total amount, and even at a sitting or like when you're eating a meal, how much protein you need to have. So right about now, I think it's hovering around 25 grams of protein at a time seems to be sort of the maximal amount that your body can use, because there's a limit to how much your gut can absorb, and, you know, a limit to how much your muscles can use at a certain time. So it's best, and it is recommended, if you are on a higher protein diet, if you're looking to build muscle mass, or if you just, that's just what you enjoy. It does seem that splitting it up, you know, into smaller little doses per day at snacks and meals is more effective and is going to help you out a little bit better to build that muscle mass that you're looking for.
Oh, that's great. That's really useful information. And I wasn't even aware that that was kind of the current research on it. Again, there's lots of stuff out there with, you know, how much you need, et cetera. And I typically recommend that you pitch it a little bit higher, because typically we don't get the targets we're aiming for. That's how what yeah. I found in my experience. So I was pitching it a bit higher than that. And like you said, kind of 0.8 to like 1.8, depending on the activity level and et cetera, is kind of yeah. what I've seen. But it's good to know that those individual portions, because there's a lot of research to suggest that there's no truth to that. There's a lot of research to back up that, you know, you want to be able to space it out and you get better, you know, better results from that. And that's where sometimes if you're looking at splitting that up and it's difficult for you to get extra meals in during a day, where supplements can come in handy. And again, they're not magical. Like, why do I need to take a protein supplement? I'm like, it's filtered milk. No, you don't need it. Like, you don't need it. That's basically what it, or something else. It's processed pea or soy, whatever it is. But realistically, a whey protein is milk that's been filtered and had sweeteners added to it. So no, you don't need it. But if you're trying to break your meals up, you're getting that 25 grams in a meal, that could be the thing you have in between the next meal, right? To bulk up that amount, because it is hard to hit those amounts. Plus, let's think about the sources of protein that are common. Is chicken breast and egg whites and things easy to eat a lot of? You have to, well, not egg whites much, but chicken breast and steak. And like, you have to chew it. It's not massively enjoyable to eat like three chicken breasts in a row. And I've done it, trust me. Because when you want to get your weight up, you know, like my frame at like 200 pounds, like I was when I was in my 20s, it's almost impossible. And that's the kind of quantity of food you need to eat. However, it's not enjoyable at all. Trust yeah. me. So, you know, we need to do that. Now, the other thing on high protein, so that was incredible information, is the other thing, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but my understanding is that when we're also eating things like that, like your chicken breast, like your slightly higher protein, is it does fill you up for longer. It takes longer to process. And this is a very marginal amount, but it takes up more calories to process that, to eat it, to digest it, etc. So if you're thinking about overall management of calories, that's where sometimes we can use protein as a tool, much like I was saying earlier. Maybe it's an artificial sweetener as a tool because you have a sweet tooth. Maybe you're having more protein. Is there much research to back that up? Am I talking complete nonsense? Have I been reading the wrong articles?
No, you're right. You're true. You're on the right track there. Yeah. So for sure, protein, and I can give you kind of the science-y nerd answer to this. So when protein hits your stomach and protein hits your gut, it does do a better job of releasing hormones in your body. They're called satiety hormones. So hormones that then go to your brain and tell your brain, wow, I'm feeling full. So protein does a better job than carbohydrate at signaling those satiety hormones to keep you feeling fuller for a longer period of time. Okay, carbs are the worst. They're not very good at starting those satiety hormones, but fat is the best. So that's why when you eat a high fat meal or a fat rich meal, you tend to feel full for a really long period of time, because fat stays in our stomach for a longer period of time. It elicits more of those satiety hormones. But nobody's really going to want to eat a high fat diet or high fat meal just to get those satiety hormones working, because they're also calorie dense, right? They're also energy dense. So protein is kind of the sweet spot in the middle where we've got a lower energy density. So proteins don't have as many calories as fats do, but they have that satiety effect too.
Yeah, that is why when I went out for dinner a couple of weeks ago and ate a 14-ounce piece of steak with a baked potato that was loaded with like sour cream and bacon and some cheese, that's why I didn't eat till like 11 o'clock on Sunday morning.
Yeah, you're right.
I was like, yeah. I was like, I can't sleep because there's so much food in my belly. Yes, that's really, really good to know. And again, it's just that useful tool, right? So this is another reason why it's marginal. However, those hormones are going to play a big part in people's maintenance of eating, maybe at the right amount of calories or even in a slight deficit of calories. It's going to have a huge part. Is it the only thing? No. And is a high protein diet going to say, oh, it's the best way to lose fat? No, it's useful. And this is one of the reasons why it's useful, right? It can have that effect on your body and you're going to feel more full up when you have those protein and fats. This is also a big, I've in the past been a big advocate of switching up what people use for their meals at the beginning of the day. So there's another big one is get your fats and proteins in early in the day, because what happens during the day is the quicker we feel hungry, in theory, the more food we're going to eat, because you're going to eat that second meal in 2 hours and then you have another meal in 2 hours. If you're eating something high in sugar, high in carbs in the morning, you're going to feel hungry pretty soon after that for most people. And then what happens is we've still got the whole day to get through. So if you're looking at managing those calories and trying to get the right, or it's just something you struggle to manage over the whole day, or like me, you want to save up some of that allocation of the food you need for the day for later in the evening, because it's when I slow down, I want to eat a little bit more. So a bigger meal and then normally something like a couple of hours after dinner is I'll go high protein and fat in the morning, higher protein and fat, because then I feel full up for longer and I don't have to worry about eating till later in the day when I have time to sit down as a family and enjoy that meal. To our point earlier, I want to be a role model. And if I don't eat during the day because I'm really busy or I just have little snacks, it doesn't really negative affect anyone because there's no one around. It's just me hanging out on my own in the basement. So it doesn't. And often as I'm coaching, someone on my feet, no one wants a full belly of food when they're moving and doing stuff. So I just typically don't eat that much during the day. So it's a perfect solution for me. Let's be clear. I'm talking about me. Anyone listening, it might work for you, but there's a few reasons why certain types of food, certain types of the day are important. It doesn't have to be a diet, quote unquote. It can just be tips to help you. I think that made sense, although I did go on a little bit of a rant. So
no, I definitely agree though. Like whatever you find the most challenging dietary wise, try to tackle that early on. Like I have a real struggle. Ironically, I'm a nutritionist. I still struggle to get the right, like the proper amount of vegetables in my diet. I love fruit, but veggies seem to be hard for me. So I make sure I have a vegetable vegetables in the morning, but like spinach with my eggs or whatever. And I have a lunch that's really heavy in vegetables so that when I'm tired at the end of the day and it's dinner time, I don't have to worry so much about making sure I get my 3 different veggies at dinner because I've already done it in the morning, right? Like tackle the hard stuff first. I do that with exercise too. That's why I work out with you in the morning, you know, because then I've done it. It's finished. It's over. I don't have to worry about it.
Oh, if it gets to midday and I've not worked out,
No way
on this planet is that happening. I remember those days of working out at the end of my shifts in the gym at like 10 p.m. So so brutal. I will never force myself to work out like that ever again. There's a really important thing we're going to kind of wrap up with, but before we do that, you mentioned something that just popped into my head because I was watching a video and I'm not gonna, I don't like to name and shame where they came from, but there was a social media video that I watched and it was about carnivore diets. Now, I know we talked about diets, but there's a very, very specific that's going around right now, which I'd love to get your opinion on because I hadn't even planned for this, but I just thought about it when you talked about vegetables, is the theory within a lot of the carnivore advocates is that vegetables particularly are toxic and that we shouldn't be eating vegetables and our body's not designed to eat them. And we should be only eating fruits and then obviously like meat-based, which is what carnivore diet is predominantly based around. It's fats, meats, and fruit. I don't even know why. I haven't found a video that talks about them being toxic to actually explain why. So now I expect you to explain it to me.
Well, this is interesting because like I feel like I've been in this field for so long, but there's always new things that come up that I don't know about. So this is actually the first that I've heard about this carnivore diet specifically focusing on that is usually not what you hear. You usually hear like, get rid of fruits because they're high in sugar or whatever, you know, whatever else, but, and focus on vegetables. But no, vegetables are not toxic. I'm thinking maybe what this person or this camp is thinking is, and it's true, there are certain vegetables that have like plant-based chemicals in them. That's part of the plant's defense chemicals that when we eat, they come into our body. But we have organs to deal with that. Like we've evolved, our livers evolved, our kidneys have evolved to take those plant compounds and break them down and get rid of them. And in certain cases, some of those plant chemicals can actually be good for us and do helpful things for our bodies. They're antioxidants. They help fight like oxidative damage and prevent cancer. So, no, I don't believe that. I wouldn't believe that. You don't want to. And I'm suspicious of any diet that's using scare tactics like that or telling you to specifically eliminate certain foods. Because, you know, when you're eliminating foods from your diet, you're eliminating the nutrients that come with those foods. And, you know, especially with fruits and vegetables, those are our powerhouses for vitamins and minerals. Right. So there's only, you know, there's a certain subset of vitamins and minerals that we're only going to get from vegetables and fruits. And we lump them together because, you know, fruits and vegetables tend to carry the same vitamins and minerals. But certain fruits are better than, you know, certain vegetables. They all carry their own unique vitamin and mineral profile. So as soon as you're getting rid of a whole category, like all of the vegetables from your diet, you're potentially missing out on some of those micronutrients that are just as important as proteins and fats and carbohydrates to our diet. So any diet, if you hear it telling you to get rid of one, like, you know, specific subset of foods, be very skeptical about it.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And I thought that was going to be a fun one because it's something yeah. I keep seeing. And it's, like you said, I can't find it. But now you have something fun to go and research. So yeah. There you go. You're welcome. So what I want to kind of wrap up with is we've touched on this a little bit in places. But for anyone listening, some practical advice. You no doubt you picked up some really good tips if you've been listening today. But I'd love to kind of share a little bit about how do we adapt our nutrition for that person maybe that's taking on a new workout regime, is adding exercise and movement in. Because I am a big believer that we have to live our health, fitness, nutrition journey with a adding in and a gaining mindset, an abundance mindset, not the opposite, not taking, like we said, taking foods out or taking things away, or, you know, and a lot of that's taking away the pleasure from food and exercises. Stop taking away things, start adding things. So if you're starting a workout regime and you're listening today and, you know, you're setting yourself a new goal, what would be some handy tips that we could give to the listeners between us for adapting nutrition for someone who's looking to increase their activity levels?
So I'm going to steal your idea. You basically just hit the nail on the head there. How you frame your changes in nutrition is key, right? And we talked about this a little bit at the start, positive versus negative language. So instead of thinking, you know, that you're changing your eating habits to, you know, lose weight, or you're restricting certain foods from your diet in order to lose weight, I think it's really helpful if you try to reframe it and think about, I'm changing the way that I'm eating to fuel my body so I can exercise. I'm making changes to my diet so I can live a healthier lifestyle. So just sort of switching the thinking from, you know, from negative, what I'm losing, to what you're gaining, right? And I think the simple switch in how we approach that is very helpful. So fueling your body, making sure you have the right nutrients to do that, as opposed to getting rid of certain things or cutting certain things out from your diet.
I love that we're on the same page with that, because it's such an important part that is so heavily missed in the world of health and fitness is what are we gaining, right? If you're trying to gain cardiovascular fitness, you're trying to gain a different shape body, because that is some people's goals. Maybe you're trying to gain more strength, more muscle. Maybe that's part of it. Is you're going to need to start to look at, like we said, right? Like, how can we fuel our body for that? Because if you're going to work out hard enough to start to make body shape changes, you're going to need energy to do that. Predominant source of energy, there's going to be carbohydrate or the what it turns into in your body after that. But you need glycogen in your muscles. That's going to fuel you. It's going to help you move. And then you're going to need protein to recover from that. You're also going to need fat to recover from that. So important, right? It has such a great effect on the body in so many mentally and physically. So yeah, start to add those things. Look at those healthy choices of fat. Look at those healthy choices of nutrition, or the more healthy choices of nutrition. Look at what carbohydrates fuel you and when you need them based on when you're working out. So when you're starting that workout regime, or if you're changing the goal, like we said, if you're trying to build muscles, look at, do I need a bit more protein in my diet? Have I actually tried to work out how much I'm having so I know? Because most people don't know, right? You know, be aware of those things. So, you know, you start to think about adding that, adding mentality will, I think, really change people's mindset for the positive towards their goal, whatever that goal is. So I love that we're on the same page. And I think a lot of everyone listening today is going to take that away as a really key point.
Can I add one more thing?
Of course.
Because this is important too. It's possibly going to be a lot of work. I think that, and I've found that too, like, you know, I want to start eating more vegetables in my diet, or I want to start doing this with my diet. You might actually have to sit down and plan out how you're going to do that, you know, like make a concrete plan for yourself. I'm going to add, you know, an extra, you know, serving of nuts with my snack. Cause if you just leave it up to, you know, spur of the moment type of decisions, chances are you're not going to do it. So actually having a concrete plan, and it might even be sitting down on a Sunday and just sort of mapping out what your week's going to look like in terms of meals or snacks, so that you know you have the right foods in your fridge and in your cupboard to help you do that during the week. Until it becomes enough of a habit and you've been consistent enough with it that you don't need to think about it, and it just becomes a part of what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will definitely back that up by saying, when you do something consistently and you do the work, right? Do the work, because let's be honest, it's not easy. And if you do the work early on and you plan and you schedule and you look at those things, you look at how much protein you're getting, how much fat you're getting, how many vegetables you're getting, and you make a concerted effort to change that, it will become habitual. Because I don't think about it all day, every day, but I'm very aware just in what I do. And, you know, I don't make a plate of food that doesn't have something that supplies micronutrients in it. But I don't think about it. I just do it. So it will become, just like exercise, it will become something that you just do. You will be a person that eats it with that mindset and is able to create a balanced meal on your plate, just the same as you'll become a person who moves and exercises every day. It happens with practice and consistency. There's no shortcuts though. So that's the message for today. Listen, we are pretty much at time here, and I want to just give my sincerest gratitude, because this has been incredible for me to learn. We joked before we started recording that this was to service everyone listening, but also to boost my ego, ensure I was getting everything right. It's like free education I don't have to go to school for in another province. So this is great. It's been incredible. Danielle, thank you so much. Is there any last parting thoughts of wisdom before we sign off?
If you're looking to make dietary changes, just be patient with yourself. It might take a little bit of time. You know, the way we eat, if we've been eating a certain way for a long period of time, it might take you some time to make some changes, but be patient with yourself. And I feel like I said this maybe on my first time on this podcast. It's okay. You know, forgive yourself if you have an off day, you know, where maybe you ate more than you wanted to, or you didn't eat as healthy as you wanted to. You had a few more pastries than you wanted to. It's okay. Tomorrow is a new day. You have a chance to start again. So it's a journey, just like an exercise journey. Changing your diet is a journey too.
Yeah. Incredible parting piece of wisdom. So thank you so much, everyone listening. Thank you. I know that everyone that's tuned in and listened today has got something valuable. All I ask is, this information is here for you free on the internet, and you've been able to learn all these amazing things. All I ask is, in return, share this episode with someone you love and care about, because that's what it's all about, is getting knowledge out there, trying to dispel some myths, because it is a really complicated topic and there's so many myths out there. And we all struggle when that's our reality, when we don't know what piece of advice to take. So share this with someone that might want a little bit of help with their nutrition, a little bit of guidance on their journey of health, fitness, nutrition, whatever it might be. And let's just spread the word out there. That's it for today's episode. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you so much for tuning in. And remember to hit the subscribe button so you never miss an episode. If you enjoyed the show, share it with at least one person and please consider leaving us a 5-star review on Apple. It really helps us reach more people. Come join our community by heading over to our website or finding us on social media. All links are in the show notes. And remember, the world of fitness is 10% facts and 90% opinion.